It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All righty, it is time for Money for Lunch. I am your host, Bert Martinez, and I'm sitting here in sunny California and having some fun, just hanging out with James Caan and his brother Ronnie at the James Caan Celebrity Golf Show tournament. Yeah, that's where we're at. Just having some fun hanging out. And anyway, it's good to have you guys here. Let's see what else is happening. Oh, nothing. All right. Great. Hey, how about that? Our system just kind of crashed a little bit. Well, that's always fun. So let's see if we can go and do the backup thing here, which we've done multiple times before because it happens. Let's see. What be happening? So, you know, yesterday I talked about protecting your brand. Richard Simmons, who has been kind of retired unofficially, you know, he's disappeared for the last 3 years, and there's been all sorts of speculations. I didn't think it was that big of a deal for him to take off, but apparently a lot of people just thought, you know, that was a big deal. And anyway, so the National Enquirer, made a big story about that the reason that Richard had disappeared is because he's going through a sex change operation, and he either is becoming or is a woman. Of course, Richard was offended by that, and he has turned around and sued the National Enquirer. Hats off to Richard Simmons, totally respect him for doing that. You know, sometimes these people in, we call it the public eye, get a lot of crud. And so hats off to them for standing up for themselves. Richard Simmons supposedly just taking a break. He is, like I said, unofficially retired, but he just kind of disappeared. And that's his prerogative. So how does this pertain to us? Well, listen, sometimes we have to be diligent. We have to be vigilant. We have to aggressively defend our brand. That's what that's all about. So somebody makes a snarky remark about your brand, and all of a sudden it blows, you know, you leave it alone because it doesn't mean anything. Before you know it, you have an issue. So just food for thought. What are you going to do when somebody maligns your brand, right? And, you know, and sometimes, again, it's a balanced situation, right? Sometimes there's maybe nothing you should do. Maybe there's nothing you can do. Maybe it's, what do you call it, just part of the business you're in, right? I mean, look, if you're the president of the United States, you're going to get criticism. You know, granted, 50% of people at least 50% of the people in the country probably are going to be dissing you. Not a whole lot you can do about it. Now, if you have consistent customer complaints, if you had bad reviews, the question is, what are you doing to aggressively protect your brand? Are you at fault? Is this a learning experience where now you can say, you know what, we could have done a better job? I had a similar experience like a month or two ago. Had a customer who was not happy with some work I did, and we're still trying to work it out. And so anyway, it just so happens. I mean, it just happens, right? Look, if you're doing regular, consistent business of any volume, you're going to have people who just aren't happy with your work, no matter how much you try. Now, of course, I'm not, you know, the Richard Simmons thing on National Enquirer, that is something completely different. And that's just being mean. Now, they're saying that they have evidence that he's had a sex change operation. And Richard Simmons, of course, denies everything. And this is what it means in this particular scenario. If it goes to trial, he will have to prove it. And that's evidence that really nobody wants to see. So anyway, good luck to Richard Simmons on that. But for us average working business owners, what are you doing to protect your brand? Right? I mean, this is important. So somebody writes up a bad review. That's all part and parcel of growing a big business. Not everybody's happy with Microsoft. Not everybody's happy with Apple. So you have to separate the critics from the criticism. So if you have a loyal customer who is unhappy with you, that could be serious. That could really hurt your business. Now, you have a critic who maybe doesn't like your industry or doesn't like the way you do things. Again, you know, what do you have in place to overcome these issues? Because we're all going to get them. And they're all good evidence that your business is thriving. So I much rather have 90% of my clients happy and 10% and have to just refund the 10%, right? However, anytime I give a refund, one of the things that we agree upon is, hey, I'm giving you this refund. You're not going to say anything bad about me. I'm not going to say anything bad about you. We just couldn't make things work, and so therefore we're going to go our separate ways. That's all. So that's typically my refund, unless somebody asks for a refund right away. They bought one of my webinar classes or one of my courses or something, and they bought it and they kept it for a day or two, and they said, hey, this is not for me, and they want a refund, no problem. We'll give them a refund right away. I'm talking about somebody who maybe is 4 or 5 months invested in something. Do they deserve a refund? Probably not, but you give it to them anyway because you're trying to do the right thing. Or you give them a partial refund or whatever it is you work out with them. When I do something like that, I always really try to protect my brand. Again, like you, all I'm trying to do is the best I can as far as growing my business and making everybody as happy as possible, right? That's all you can really do. Okay, so just thought I'd throw that out there because, like I said, this deal with Richard Simmons, I think, it just got me thinking about it. And most likely, you and I will never end up as part of a National Enquirer news piece. And that's the good news. The bad news is that we're not going to make everybody happy, nor should we even try. It's one of those things that sometimes we get so bogged down, obsessing sometimes over what somebody has said that it hangs us up too much. Look, no matter how good you are, no matter how sincere you want to help people, you cannot help everybody. And that's just the reality. And if you're going to try to make every customer super happy, then your business is going to stagnate, right? I personally only want to make those clients happy that I can make happy. People who resonate with my sense of humor, people who you know, like what I'm doing. And those who don't like what I'm doing, I want to repel those guys and quickly give them a refund and quickly just help them find somebody else that can help them. Does that make sense? How about that, man? I'm telling you, we're just – the great thing about doing a live show is that whatever can happen will happen. And anyway, so just dealing with some technical issues today. That's, again, all part and parcel of doing the show. All right, enough about my thoughts on keeping everybody happy or refunds or Richard Simmons. Let's get this party started with my first guest, Elizabeth B. Cook. I'm sorry, Elizabeth B. Crook. Elizabeth is the CEO of Orchard Advisors. Let's try that again. Elizabeth
Orchard.
B. Crook.
Orchard
Advisors. Thank you. For the past 20-plus years, Elizabeth Crook has helped CEOs and entrepreneurs think and act strategically to grow their companies and find greater personal satisfaction. She has shown countless of individuals of all generations how to invent and reinvent themselves. Crook knows how to inspire people to gain fresh sense of what they can accomplish in their lives, think about themselves with compassion, develop a sense of humor about their challenges, and ultimately take action. Elizabeth Crook, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you very much, Bert.
It's good to
and
have you here.
I got to tell you, I can hear you. You are obviously living large. You are doing the right thing because you were just riffing away, and it was fantastic.
Thank you so much. It just, you caught that. Yeah, so absolutely. And you know what? So I want to talk about this because this is so important. Here in the intro, you say develop a sense of humor about their challenges, because really, if you can laugh about your challenges, you're halfway there. And I think sometimes that's a hard thing to do, right? I mean, sometimes you need a day or two before you can start laughing at it, because some challenges are deeper than others. But having a sense of humor, Elizabeth, is really such an important skill to have.
Yes, and it's easier to have a sense of humor about ourselves when we have a high level of self-awareness. Then we can move to humor and compassion instead of judgment, which is our favorite place to be. I should have, or I shouldn't have, or I could have, or I would have, and then we get all in a ball instead of saying, wow, what did I learn from that experience? What did I get from that experience?
Yes, I like that. And this is so vitally important. This is so vitally important. I cannot tell you how vitally important that is. All right, so let's talk about this. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get from where you are to where you are today? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I finished school, moved to New York, take on the big city, and I did lots of different things there, and then I came back to the South, got a graduate degree, and then I moved to South America for 12 years, where I ran a couple of companies, and I always wanted to be a something. I wanted to be a doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief, and I wasn't any of those things. And I was working in a technology company when I got a call from a headhunter who said, we're looking for somebody to start a chain of donut franchises. And I said, well, that's interesting because I don't have any food experience. I don't have any consumer product experience. I don't have any franchise experience. And frankly, I hate donuts. So why am I on your list? And the guy said, what were your search criteria? He said, well, it's interesting because there are no content experts in country. And so we decided to look for a person who had a record of success doing things that had never been done before. And it was the first time I knew what I was. And it was a great gift because I recognized that what strung together all of these different experiences and being the first woman in this and the first woman in that or initiating a new program was indeed what I did. And it helped me understand that one of my talents is seeing themes and patterns and really thinking strategically about how we're going to accomplish whatever this thing is. And so when I came back to the States, I worked with a couple of companies and helped them grow and then joined one of them. And when I left them, I thought, what is it I really most want to do? So that's what led me back to consulting.
Yeah, I love it. All right, so let's talk about your new book, Live Large, The Achiever's Guide to What's Next. What does living large mean to Elizabeth Crook?
It means you are living in all of whom you are. And today I posted a blog at elizabethbcrook.com. And imagine, Bert, that you are living in your house. And it's okay, but, you know, it's a little bit cramped, and there are days you can't do what you like to do, and you open the door and you discover that there are three more rooms in your house, you would say, holy whatever, I can't believe I haven't been using all of this space. And living large is when we, in effect, use all the space that we have. We open up all of those rooms of who we are, and we live deeply out of our talents, out of our skills, our experience, our passion, and we do that in a very intentional way. So that's what live large is. It's about choosing to live in that big way.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. All right, so let's talk about this. What was the catalyst? What was the inspiration for writing the book, Live Large, The Achiever's Guide to What's Next? What compelled you to write this book?
Well, I have been working as a business strategist, as you said, for 20-plus years. I help companies grow their bottom line and have more fun or have greater satisfaction. And it's all about making choices. It's about saying, given where we've been, given what our core competencies are, given all of these things, what are, and given where we want to go, what are the choices or the strategies, the priorities that we want to establish in light of that? And despite the fact of having a successful consultancy, I had people just come to me as individuals and say, gosh, Elizabeth, you know, I'm really kind of stuck in my career. I'm not sure what I want to do next. Can you just help me out? Everybody says you're really good at helping. You're a good figure-outer, if that's a word. And so over the years, having worked with many, 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 many people, I developed a process that turned out to be very powerful. And finally, a good friend of mine and mentor said, a CEO who'd made a successful exit out of her business, she said, you just have to write the book. In fact, she said, write the damn book. And so I wrote the book. And it's been very exciting and a lot of fun, because I know that when people follow the explorations, it is so liberating and so powerful for them and so deeply satisfying for me.
Yeah. No, I like that. I like that.
You know what? And sometimes writing that book can be kind of a scary thing. I mean, it's easy to say, hey, I'm going to write a book. And I think it's fairly, you know, writing a book itself can be a little bit of a challenge. But pulling the trigger and publishing the book, that's the real deal. That separates you from everybody else.
Well, I had a good model. My father was a pediatrician. And when he was 69, he always wrote. He had a syndicated column, but he saw patients. But he did a radio show once in Cincinnati. This was back in the 80s. And the station got 7,000 phone calls. So he put down the book that he was writing on his main topic and switched to topics. And the book sold over 1 million copies and, in fact, still sells today. So the model of writing a book, you know, when you're in full maturity, even as your first book, and he went on to write many books after that, I had a good model for that. And I think the other part of it is I feel so passionate about helping people get out of their own way, give themselves permission to do what they can do.
Yeah. No, and I think that's interesting, that whole word about permission, giving ourselves permission is so important. Let's talk about this. One of the stories you share in the book, Live Large, deals with working in a job that is against one's value. Let's talk about this a little bit. How often do you think this happens?
Well, it happens in two different ways, because I work with a small number of individuals. I also work with CEOs, and I have come to actually do this personal planning with CEOs prior to working with their entire company. And I've recently written an article about losing perspective, and I tell the story of a CEO who had someone on his team. And, in fact, the first time I met her, I thought, oh, dear, this woman's trouble. But he told me, you know, we just brought her in from overseas. She is fantastic. She's going to grow this entity, and I know she can be a bit of a prima donna, but we're going to just work with it. I said, okay. So as time passed, she got more and more vicious. Her language was vicious. She was difficult to deal with on the management team, and one day she just crossed a line in her language with one of her colleagues. I went back to the CEO and I said, so as I recall, one of your values has to do around strength of team. help me understand how this woman is in line with that value. And he kind of shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I guess she isn't really, but it's just I can't really talk about it. And I said, so another one of your values has to do with integrity, is that right? And he just knew the direction I was going. He said, I get it. He said, I'm not acting in alignment with my values, and that's why I hate going to these meetings, because she is in conflict with everything I believe in. And so I didn't have to tell him. I just had to ask him, how do these values fit the choices that you're making here? And that's why understanding what they are, because most of us have a feeling when we step across that line, but when we have articulated what our values are, it gives us a way of saying, oh, no wonder this doesn't feel so good. This is not really who I am.
Yeah, that is so, we call it, interesting. And so, all right, so let's talk about this, because I find this to be so interesting.
In a scenario like that, is leaving a job like that the best answer? I mean, terminating that person, you know, I mean, you're talking to the CEO, so obviously he's not going to leave the job. So what do you do in a circumstance when you have somebody who is causing so much, what do you call it, negative energy, so much distraction, toxicity in a business that's not aligned with your value? Because, I mean, it seems to me like you only have a couple options. You can leave the business, you can try to fire that individual, or you could try to train that individual. Am I missing anything?
No, you're right. And if you think about employees, for example, as being either what you want are people who are highly competent and getting the job done, and people who are also have a great attitude. If they have both, then, you know, that's what we call an A player. If they have a great attitude but poor performance, I call those heartbreakers, because here in the South we say, bless their hearts, they're just doing the best they can. But they are not delivering what the company needs. And then the last one is the one who grinds at the work, but nobody likes to work with them. And they are terrorists, because they'll blow up your organization. And with companies, I say, you can't keep those people. If you can coach up the people who have a great attitude so they can do the job, fine. If you can, or train them, if you can coach up the people with a bad attitude, fine. But you really need to get rid of them if you can. You need to free up their future and let them go someplace where they can fit the culture. When it comes to individuals, I had an employee who, well, I'll tell my story, which I tell in the book. When I was working overseas, I took a full-time role as a consultant for a year with a not-for-profit organization, and it was part of a national literacy program. I was getting multinational companies involved, and on Secretary's Day, which was a big deal, they closed the office. We went to a nightclub, and there was, you know, 15-year-old scotch down the middle of the table, and it was a disco, and all I could think of was, I'm asking people for money, and this is how we're using other people's money? And I could see time after time where expenditures in that not-for-profit were being made to either glamorize or make more comfortable the people on the staff instead of being directed to programs. And when that became clear, I realized I couldn't stay in an organization that didn't have the same sense of financial integrity and responsibility, fiduciary responsibility, that I had. And so I left after, you know, after a year, because I couldn't feel proud of what I was doing. I think that that's a signal. If you don't feel proud, if you don't feel proud when you say, I work for so-and-so, that's a signal that even if you haven't written your values down, that you're probably in a place that doesn't align with what your personal values are. And it's a hard decision.
Yeah, it is a hard decision. It's scary. That's what makes it so hard. I mean, you know, if you don't need the money. Yeah, if you don't need the money, then you can. It's so easy to live by your values when you're not, when you don't need the money. Now, when you need the money and then you step away from something that's supporting you, that's always scary. Now, of course, the intelligent way to do it is to look for a job or a way to transition financially so you don't have that interruption. But that's what makes it so scary. Well, let's talk about this, because you also write about how feeling worn out and disconnected is a sign that one is nearing a turning point. So let's talk about this turning point. What do you say to people that you know, to keep them encouraged and that motivates them and encourages them. Talk about that as well.
Well, the people sort of know they're in a turning point when either they're stuck or they want something more, but they're not quite sure what it is. Or they say, I had a young woman come and she said, you know, when I look at my boss's job, I don't want that job. And I feel like I've learned as much as I can here, and I really want to expand. So that's the signal. Of course, the short answer, the self-serving answer is, well, go buy my book. But the longer answer is to really be clear about several things, and the explorations in the book help people get there. But you want to create options, because too often, especially if we've been in one industry or one kind of career, we think we have fewer choices than we actually have. And one thing is to actually look at where you've come from, but also get clear about what are the kinds of activities that you find inherently energizing and interesting and exciting. Now, I love working with groups. I love leading retreats. I love working one-on-one with people. And it turns out I love writing. That's one of the great things that's come out of writing the book, is I've got several more lined up. And what are the things that are depleting? Please don't ask me to figure out this new software program that we've got. Please don't make me do that, because it just wears me out. And we all have things like that. So, number one, what really energizes you? Number two is, what are the things that you know about? There may be contents related to your industry, and what are the processes that you know about? So you know about interviewing. You know about engaging people in a way that gets them talking. So could you be other things than a host of a radio and podcast? Absolutely. You could be an investigator. You could be a therapist. You could be many things that would build on that talent that you have for that. But it would be tempting to say, well, all I know is radio, instead of saying I have this process. So that when you look at the things that energize you and the processes you know about and you map them together, somewhere in there is your talent. And we're truly living large when we're living out of our talent, the thing that we just do because it's just who we are.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? And it's funny.
I bet you ask people questions all the time.
I do. I ask people questions because isn't that how we learn? I mean, you and I, all of us, are asking ourselves questions all the time. A lot of times they're not very empowering. Like, why am I always running late? Why can't I control my temper? I can't seem to ever save money. We ask ourselves these very limiting questions, as opposed to how can I further expand my talent? I'm good at this. What else can I do with this? All this knowledge. You start asking questions like that, and all of a sudden you start realizing, you know what? I could write a book about this. I could have an online course about my skill. I could do this other stuff. Maybe I could start a podcast. And all of a sudden, this one talent that you have, because you've asked the right questions, all of a sudden that one talent, it pours over into multiple ways of expressing that talent. Because one of the things that I've learned is that we are – one of our purposes for all of us is to constantly expand and to fulfill the measure of our creation. You know, people sometimes ask, well, when is enough enough? And the question is never, because life, there is no, you know, there is only abundance in life. Either life is constantly expanding or it's dead. There is no standing still. So my point being is I like what you're talking about there. What else can you do with what you've got is really what we're all about. So you're helping CEOs. You've written a book that helps CEOs. What else can you do? Well, hey, I'm going to do some interviews. I'm going to write some articles. I'm going to do some videos. And all of a sudden you've taken what you know and you've multiplied it without necessarily reinventing the wheel.
Yes, and I also had to get over some of my own fears. So the
yes.
first time I did a publicity summit in New York, I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have to go pitch what I have to say. How am I going to learn how to do that? Or when they told me, you have to build a platform for your book. You need to start a blog. I need to start a blog? I started writing 5 years ago, and I write an article a week now. If somebody had told me back then, I would have said, I can't possibly do that. But it's in the beginning. You just say, I'm going to start. It doesn't have to be perfect. I got help. One of the things I do, and if people go to the website, elizabethbcrook.com, they'll find it's a short way to get to a success plan because it reminds you of what you've done in the past that have led you to be successful in new areas of your life. And but we all have our fears, especially when we're going in new directions, and part of it is in recognizing
yes.
that voice, recognizing that hesitation and saying, oh, I know you. I've seen you before. But what I know now is that I'm not a little kid. I now am an experienced professional. I have these sets of resources and support. And even though that voice in my head is saying these things, what I know to be true is I can do this.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's fantastic. All right, so let me ask you this. When you were getting ready to publish your book, and you hit that,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever you call it, fear, you hit the wall, you have to pull the trigger. So we all come up with that, oh, man, is this going to be good enough? You know, am I going to be criticized? Am I going to be embarrassed? You know, whatever runs through our head. What got you to finally publish the book? What was the thing that you finally said, okay, boom, I got the book written, I'm going to do it no matter what? Was there a specific thing that finally got you to do it?
Well, you know, the writing and publishing in some ways are two different processes.
It is, yeah.
And so I found early on a woman who was a great development editor, and she just said, I want you to just write and write and write. But before she agreed to take me on as a client, because she only takes a very small number of writers, she said, I want you to write why you think this book picked you as the writer. I want you to tell me who this book is for and why this book needs to be written now. And then I said, you know, I have a structure in mind. And she said, don't worry about that, just write. And so I wrote and wrote and wrote. And then it was almost like assembling a quilt. She helped put the pieces together, and there were pieces I wrote that we took out. There are pieces when I could see the pattern that she said, you know, I think you need to write a section on this. And so I would write a section on that. And then there's so many choices in publishing today, I had to make decisions about that. So I think what actually drove me was my belief, based on my experience working with people, that this process and this material was so liberating. And you know, Bert, there's so many challenges we have in the world today, and I think that if each of us is living out of our full house, living our talents, then I think we have a better chance of solving a lot of complex problems, because people are going to be happier. People are going to be
okay.
more forgiving of self and others. People will be more engaged. And I think it sounds corny, but I think it makes the world a better place.
Yeah, it does. It does. Absolutely. And I think that, I think that's the right attitude. I think that is the, we'd call it a great mindset. Elizabeth B. Crook, we're out of time. I'd love to bring you back and talk more. It's been so much fun having you on the show today, and very excited about your new book. The book, again, is called Live Large, The Achiever's Guide to What's Next. It's available at Amazon and wherever good books are sold. Elizabeth B. Crook is the author. Elizabeth, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. And if people buy it today, there's some amazing free offerings. So just know
free
that.
Free offerings, free stuff, free bonuses. And they can buy it today on Amazon for the free bonuses, or where?
They need to go to yourwidehorizon.com.
Say that one more time.
Yourwidehorizon.com.
Yourwidehorizon.com. Elizabeth, thank you so much for stopping
mm-hmm.
by. Good stuff there from Elizabeth B. Crook, and I just love really just loved her energy, loved her story there. And I hope you got some good nuggets out of Living Large. The book, again, is Live Large, The Achiever's Guide to What's Next. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're Donald Duck or Donald Trump. We all have to deal with our fears, and sometimes the only way to deal with it is just to do it. And, you know, that's it. Anyway, so good stuff there. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. My next guest, Maura Sweeney. Maura Sweeney, a voice for a better world. Maura Sweeney shares a living happy inside-out mantra through books, podcasts, a Huffington Post column, international speaking, and over 200 media interviews. Using reflective questions and insightful stories, she helps individuals find their voice, entrepreneurs develop their brand, and leaders emerge into their most influential and highest version of self. Maura Sweeney, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Bert, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Absolutely. And I just love your title, Ambassador of Happiness. So I have to ask you, how did you get the title of Ambassador of Happiness? Talk about this.
Well, I'm so glad you invited me to speak on things like influence and leadership and branding. These are the very things I talk about. Had you ever heard of an Ambassador of Happiness before?
I have
not. Right? Not until me. Do you believe that when I was really little, I decided I was going to grow up to be happy, and I wanted to meet people everywhere around the world. And my life story was completely designed differently. I had a mother who didn't want me to go out of the house. I was supposed to be a lawyer and basically stay at my home in New Jersey. And yet, I decided, in spite of all the other things I did in life, that I had a destiny. And when I finally decided that I was going to start writing about happiness, people laughed at me. But I kept doing what I loved. And my message always was the same. Do what you love. Do what you're interested in. And it just so happened that a couple of years ago, maybe 2 years ago, I was invited to speak at the first ever Nelson Mandela Day celebrations. They were hosted outside the nation's capital. And when they asked what I wanted to be announced as, I said, well, I'm just my name. I represent myself and I write about happiness and travel. And they said, we have the perfect title. You're the Ambassador of Happiness. And where people used to laugh at me thinking, oh, that sounds ridiculous. It sounds like fairy dust. People did not take me seriously. I ended up speaking that same weekend in front of students from 27 different countries. And I said to them all the same thing. I said, you have an opportunity to be a leader. Do what's important to you. Follow what's important from within. And eventually, the world makes room for you, just as it did for me, to now be the trademarked and recognized Ambassador of Happiness, even where foreign press introduces and interviews me as the Ambassador of Happiness, which I am.
Yeah, and you know what? And this is such a great title. It's memorable, and it has a lot of power to it, too. So it's a great, you know, the person who did that for you, Maura, did a great job, because that Ambassador of Happiness, how are you not going to remember that? It just it's not only a noble title, but it carries a lot of power, and everybody wants to know how they can be happier.
You know what? I think it's becoming a greater value now. I just knew as a little child, watching a lot of old people, that the most powerful, influential, and happiest people, and I'm just talking about people that I could see around me, adults around me, were people who were living a life that was authentic, and reflective of who they really were on the inside, meaning they didn't make excuses for themselves. They stepped out. They lived life large on their own terms, and that never left me. And because I was in the opposite situation, being trained and brought up to be something that really was unlike me, namely a New Jersey, New York lawyer, I knew how important it was to really be able to spread out my own wings and do those things that I loved. And it's in those places, Bert, that I discovered, long before the Harvard study discovered it, that when you follow those things that are really true and make you happy, you will perform better and you will be more powerful at it. So I might have been an okay, you know, New Jersey, New York lawyer, but I'm a great ambassador of happiness.
I love that. I love that. Okay, and I want to point this out because you had this career change, if you will. Here you are. You're an attorney for how long?
Actually, I left law school midstream. If anybody ever wanted to look at a picture of me back then, they'd think, I know why. I looked like The Walking Dead. I left midstream and left behind a family, I want to say legacy and expectation, which is really hard for people to do. I just
sure.
knew that I wanted to be able to get out of bed in the morning and get going and do what I was here and meant to do. And being in a profession that was going to last me 40 years, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't bring myself to stay on a path that I had no passion for. So I ended up in a career in corporate America, did very well in management and developing of other people and developing other leaders. I loved it, developing cultures. I did very well. I was a homeschooling mom. I helped my husband build a company. But it wasn't until I hit like 50 years old, our daughter was getting ready to go to college, and I thought, guess what? There is absolutely nothing holding me back. Now I'm going to be exactly who I want to be, doing what I want to do. But I had really waited all those years and developed all that prior experience, Bert, to be that person that could actually go out with, as you said, a sense of power, a sense of credibility, and a sense of knowing, rather than saying, hey, here I am at 25, I'm going to travel the world and tell you how to live a good life. So it all kind of worked well together. And I think there's a lot
now,
of everyone.
Sure. And one of the things I want to point out is that as an ambassador of happiness, you started this career at the young age of 50.
Nervy, right? Isn't that nervy for a female who has no background, no media contacts, no institution, no big title? In fact, I had left every title behind, and all I did was start writing stories and doing short videos, traveling, interviewing people, everything that was important to me, and every digital opportunity that came up, whether it was blogging or YouTubing or podcasting or interviewing, I took advantage of every single one of those things, and I wrote and shared, and eventually it was like the paradigm of everything shifted. I could remember the day I was in Liverpool, England, and I was doing a story on the Beatles and how the Beatles got their start. They were not even known. They were unknowable. And I wanted to do a story on them. I ended up doing some research, walked into the BBC studios, and the next thing I knew, they had me on the other side of the microphone where they were interviewing me as a Huffington Post contributor and wanted to know my opinions on U.S. culture and politics. And it was amazing. It was as if I kept doing what I liked, and suddenly people around me and environments around me started to reflect back to me all that I was giving into it and all that I was pursuing and training myself to do. And when I say a lot of this is relatable, Bert, you're in a situation every day, you're giving people money for lunch, and I inspire people to become their own version of currency, and that is by doing what they love, following what they're passionate about, and constantly working at it, even through, you know, failures or, oh, this didn't work out. But you just keep following it, and eventually you become a master in your own right, and then other people think, wow, this person's got a couple of talents. They're really unusual. We need them. They're the moment. They're the person of the day. Let's bring them in.
Right. Yeah, that's amazing stuff. And I like that phrase that you used, become your own currency. Is that what you said?
Yes, yes. Because oftentimes, think about this. We are busy running after the money, and we lose ourselves. What I do is change it around and say, find yourself, be yourself, exercise your best skills, your best talents, and then I always tell people, add your own value to it. You know, coming out of a corporate background, sales management, think about people who will move from maybe one industry to another, one corporation to another, and they could get lost in the mix. They're working for money, for currency, but think about this, when those individuals become known and identifiable by their own values, maybe it's great service, maybe it's loyalty to those that they serve, it could be anything, that very thing about them and their internal skills becomes part of their personal currency, and it carries a value. And when we can do that, we actually are able to transfer that currency from point A to B, from place one to two. People that knew us and trusted us will continue to come with us, trust us, and know us in our next venue or our next incarnation, whatever it may be.
Yeah, no, and the key phrase there is that people who know, like, and trust us will follow us. Absolutely. I mean, we've seen this time and time again, where we've seen somebody go from maybe the world of The Rock. He was a wrestling star. Now he's a movie star, and people have followed him there. And then we see this, again with we call singers who become or musicians who become something else, writers, again, actors or whatever. So people will follow you because they already know, like, and trust you. And how many times have we seen people who go from being somewhat in the public eye, maybe they've had a fairly significant business career, and then they go into politics, and again, people follow them there as well. So let's talk about this, getting back to happiness. What does internal happiness have to do with personal branding and influence?
I think it has everything to do with it. You know, I mentioned that I had a corporate career, and I remember being responsible for, 20, sometimes up to 75 people, salespeople and managers. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, how am I going to get everybody to make their numbers, to be successful, to do everything the corporation wants? And what I learned from that decade in corporate leadership is that I had to help people find their own identity, to develop their skills, to become an expert in their own right, and to be given the value that they were entitled to be able to make some mistakes, to step out and in making an environment and creating a culture where people felt empowered and they felt happy and they were being drawn up rather than pushed down, people did so much better in those environments. In fact, I could tell you this one story. I was in my mid-20s. I was managing an office down here in Tampa at one of the largest telecom companies in the country. We had the number one office at the time. And it was because, not because we had the best rates, we didn't have the best marketing, we didn't have the best advertising, we didn't even necessarily have the biggest market here in Tampa. But what we had was a culture of happiness and liberation where people all valued one another. They had a great attitude. They had a great value system that was all aligned. And people, rather than feeling, that terrible pressure of, oh my gosh, could I make the numbers, which is trudging, they would feel creative, empowered, they'd have fun. And we ended up with not just me as having the top office, but sales managers reporting into me and other managers. And it was success that kept breeding success. So much of it has to do with the atmospheres we set up, the ways in which we think, and the vibration that we give out. Are we taking advantage of other people or are we empowering them? And I just learned that when you're happy, you could do things so much better than you ever could. It's like almost adding air to your wings rather than feeling like you're pulling along the ball and chain. And it works. I mean, I've lived it. It works. So even when I speak about this, I don't just pull it out of a hat. I lived it. And sometimes I lived it under great stress. But I always saw those kinds of elements work well together for people.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, too, at the top of the show, you were talking about Nelson Mandela. And one of the things that he's so respected, certainly one of the reasons I admire him so much, is, you know, this is a guy who spent 26 years in prison. He was tortured. He was abused. He was, you know, whatever. And certainly he could have come out of that situation and he could have been revengeful. He could have been bitter. He could have been all these things. But he chose not to. He chose to be a guy who was happy and looked for the good in people. And, again, I'm not saying that he was absolutely perfect. None of us are. But this guy really tried to live what you're talking about from the inside out.
You know, Bert, I'm so glad you mentioned that because you are ready to hit on one of the primary points I always make about living happy from the inside out. I've written several books. I have a major course on foundations of happiness. And what I always inspire people to do is to go within and check out their mindset, because we can look at every single situation in life through two lenses. We can either see ourselves as a victim, and how often do we, right? Like, the world
right.
is bigger than
All
I am.
Time.
What did so-and-so do, right? So that's why people think they have lots of problems. They only have a choice. Am I a victim? Or secondly, am I a beneficiary? Do you know Nelson Mandela? Not that you and I either ever have met him, but you could look at that man's face in pictures and see he came through a difficult time and he came out a beneficiary, a free man, and a world changer who not only changed his own nation, but he affected the world. We can go through trying times, but Bert, when we see ourselves as ultimate beneficiaries, then everything starts ultimately to work not only for our good, but for the good of others around us. And we end up becoming a positive influence in a world that's oftentimes, you know, hampered by negative, divisive, and discouraging thoughts. And it's an extremely powerful place to live. And I would agree with you, Nelson Mandela, you could just look at him, think about him, and you see that brightness from the inside out. And I've seen it in others as well. It's because people will take trying times and they'll turn it or allow those times to make them into something great, something better, something awesome, and inspire others to do the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let me ask you this. What is your best advice or strategy that you would give someone who wants to gain influence?
Best advice is probably the most simple advice I was given. Two words, be yourself. The first time I remember that hit me was I was a salesperson and my manager called me up and said, Maura, we want you to manage the office. And I remember thinking, oh, I can't do this. I'm still learning my own craft. And the guy that was asking me to take his place was midlife, big guy, built like a refrigerator, would wear wingtip shoes. And I was about, you know, 25 years old, skinny stick. So there was nothing that I could imagine to fill this man's successful shoes. And he said, Maura, don't ever try to be like me. You step into this position and you be yourself. So that's anyone's advice. I want to take it a step further, though. You know, you could say be yourself. And so what does that mean? Does that mean like, okay, I'm going to be my worst self? I would say be your best and your highest version of self. Remember, there's only one Elvis. There's only one Madonna. There's only one Prince. And everybody else who's trying to be another version of somebody else will always be a carbon copy and a lookalike. But if you could find those things within you that are important to you, whether it's skills that you want to work on, if it's a cause that you feel very passionate about, if it's something you want to solve, and you constantly work that and you do it according to your own leanings, you will literally embody that natural influence over the course of time. You carry it. It's not just that you're talking about it. You become that very person of influence.
Yeah, I like that. I think that this idea of being yourself, and let me tell you, it's easy to say, not always easy to do, because it takes us a while to figure out who we are. What are our values? What do we stand for? And so those things take time, and the what's interesting to me, if you think of somebody, whether they're young or old, who are truly comfortable being themselves, who are truly comfortable being in their own skin, they have a magnetic attraction. People love being around them. They're transparent and all these other things. And you can just tell this person is so comfortable being themselves that it gives you permission to be yourself. And you're so relaxed around them.
You know what? I'm smiling here on the other end of the line. I totally agree with you. And not only do I agree, I know it because I was brought up to be something I was not. So I understand how conflicted people could feel or restricted and inauthentic when they're living in somebody else's skin, trying to be somebody they're not. But the more you step out and you step into those things that are you, that do reflect who you are, the more you carry yourself that way. And it's freeing for the person that that embodies it. But I have always said this too, Bert, when you are that kind of an individual, everywhere you go, you give people silent permission and encouragement to go out and become their best and most authentic self too.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's such a marvelous thing to be able to do that for other people. All right, let's talk about personal branding. What's your best advice or strategy that you give someone, that you can give someone on personal branding? Talk about this.
Oh, all right. I love personal branding, and I'm going to tell you this. I have had to develop branding because I ended up in several occasions working for corporations that really didn't know their own brand. And so when you're going out in the marketplace and people say, well, what are you and what do you have? You really have to do a good job thinking. So here's what I would encourage other people to do. Find two or three things that you really like, that you're curious about, that you're passionate about, or you want to remedy or solve or advance. Take skills you already have. Take a value you have. And I had mentioned this earlier, like, you know, for some people, it might be they love service. And work two or three of those elements together. And when you do, what happens is that you become, remember those old-fashioned ice cream cones? You'd go maybe to a boardwalk, and they would say, well, what two flavors do you want, or what three flavors? And they'd run them together, and they'd have a design in them. I think about that with branding, because think about all the kids that come out of universities today, and let's say they get an accounting degree or a marketing degree. Or maybe somebody comes out with a science degree. Well, there you have your training. But how do you distinguish yourself from anybody else? Well, maybe you know a second language from the way you were brought up at home or from your family life. Maybe you had somebody in your family that taught you an unusual skill. And then maybe there's something that you are really passionate about. As you take those two or three things and weave them together, over a course of time, that may mean like you might stumble, you might make some, I don't even want to say mistakes, there are no mistakes, but you keep trying new things, eventually you crystallize into something that's uniquely you. And there, it's that combination of things that takes you from being, I would say, as a commodity, like sugar or flour or something that everybody is a Me Too brand, into someone that has certain skills and knowledge within them, but they also have these other finer attributes. You put them together and you have your own brand.
Yeah. And again, this is something that goes back to starting with, you know, knowing yourself, right? And knowing what your values are. And then you build your brand on top of that. And
yeah,
and some of us get sidetracked because we look at somebody and we say, ooh, I can do some of the stuff that Maura can do. I want to be kind of like Maura, or I want to be kind of like this person. And you're trying to fumble around and figure out what your brand is. You're trying to figure out who yourself is. And again, that it's easy to say, sometimes a little bit difficult to do. So let me ask you this. Here I am. I'm trying to figure out what my brand is. Where do I start?
I love to tell people, go back to your own childhood. I love this. Mm. When I was little, I would look at airplanes in the sky thinking, oh, I want to go meet those people from other countries. I used to love watching the Kennedys in the White House. I'm obviously dating myself. I'm 59, but I remember this. And I used to be a doodler. I could, you know, do little artwork. And I was a story-based person. I love the stories of people's lives. So I travel the world. I've been to about 60 countries. My own artwork as frames in my books, in my blogs.
Right.
I'm a storyteller. So not only do I interview people, but I share stories everywhere I go. That's my brand. So people who know what they liked when they were little kids, and all they have to do sometimes is just get on their own, close their eyes, put their hand over their, like over their chest, which kind of gets your mind away from the intellect, and just say to yourself, all right, what was I doing when I was a little kid? What did I love? And oftentimes the things that make you smile, those crazy things you did as a kid, games you'd play, things you'd imagine, those are your little beginnings of those threads that you could start pulling on and working and exercising until you create something that's uniquely you for today and for the world and the circumstances that you find yourself in. And before you know it, you could become a creative doing something that makes you happy, maybe helps other people, and gives you a brand new identity in your adult life. And it could all start in your childhood years.
I love it. I love it. Maura Sweeney, we're out of time. We're going to end on that note. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Looking forward to having you back again.
Well, thanks again for having me, and may everybody else enjoy their money for lunch today, Bert.
All righty. I love it. Good stuff there from Maura Sweeney, and I just love her energy, and it's hard to imagine that she's 59 years old. She sounds more like she's 29 years old. If you want to find out more about Maura and her team, you can go to Maura, M-A-U-R-A, the number 4 and the letter U.com, MauraForYou.com, and always good to have you guys here. I'm excited each and every day because I get to spend time with you, and I appreciate your support. I appreciate you connecting with me on LinkedIn, on Facebook, on Twitter, on YouTube. If you haven't done so, check out my YouTube channel. Interestingly enough, one of my latest videos that is getting a lot of hits right now is How to Get Rich by Being Yourself. So check it out. It's on youtube.com/Bert Martinez or /Bert J. Martinez. And always looking to meet with you guys as always. Thank you so much for being here. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on